Imagine, just for a second, a really high-stakes scenario. You're an independent content creator, right? Maybe you record from your bedroom using like a USB microphone you bought on sale.
Or, maybe you're on the exact opposite end of the spectrum. You run a massive professional production studio like Solid Gold.
Right. Yeah. You're managing huge corporate budgets, high-end clients, a full staff, but either way, you get the call.
The dreaded call.
Exactly. You are walking into the South African Parliament. The heavy wooden doors close behind you. You sit down, and you are fully expecting to be handed this, like, draconian rule book.
A rule book that completely restricts your microphone, dictates your content, and essentially tells you how to run your entire show.
Yeah, you're bracing for the ultimate fight for your creative life. But then the session actually starts. The politicians begin to speak, and you slowly realize the government isn't actually hunting you at all.
No, they're not. They are hunting the multi-billion-dollar tech giants who host you.
Which is just an incredible twist. And that is our mission for this deep dive today. We are going to decode this unprecedented, frankly historic, multi-party roundtable.
Yeah, held by the Portfolio Committee on Communications and Digital Technologies. This was on March 25th, 2026.
And just to give you, the listener, a sense of the scale here, the stack of sources we are drawing from is massive. We've got this comprehensive analysis report detailing all the transcripts and positions of legislators from across the political spectrum.
Right, and we have the regulators too, ICASA, the Film and Publication Board, plus the global tech platforms themselves, representatives from Meta, Google, TikTok.
And crucially, we have the podcasters and the industry bodies. Everyone from the Podcast and Chill Network to the South African Podcasters Guild, sitting right alongside civil society organizations and media law experts.
It's honestly rare to get all of those conflicting interests into a single parliamentary room. And the
Yeah.
stakes for you, the listener, I mean, they just could not be higher.
Exactly. Whether you're that independent creator trying to build a brand or a studio executive at Solid Gold trying to predict, where corporate advertising budgets are going to shift, or even just a heavy consumer of digital content on your morning commute. The rules of the game are shifting beneath your feet.
We are rapidly moving from the wild west of the internet into this highly structured, fiercely contested new era of digital economics.
So, okay, let's unpack this. I think we need to start by dispelling the absolute biggest fear going into that March 25th session.
Oh, the censorship fear.
Yeah, exactly. The prevailing narrative on social media the night before was just pure panic. Everyone thought podcasters were about to be heavily censored by the state.
Right, but the chairperson, Kosela Sangonigo, she opened the floor and completely flipped the script. Her framing was incredibly deliberate.
She just shut that rumor down immediately.
She did. She explicitly stated that this session was not about regulating individual podcasts. She wanted to make it abundantly clear that the state has no interest in sitting in a room and deciding what someone can or cannot say into a microphone in their garage.
Right. So what was the point of the whole gathering then, if not that?
She framed it as a necessary engagement with a multi-billion rand digital industry that right now currently exists outside the traditional bounds of the South African economy.
Wow.
Yeah, she actually had to walk back some earlier committee correspondence that had panicked the industry. She assured everyone that there was no predetermined outcome, no like secret draft bill waiting in a drawer to license podcasters.
I can only imagine the collective sigh of relief from the creators sitting in that room. I mean, you're sweating bullets, and she says that. But she didn't just tell them to go on their merry way and keep recording, did she?
No, not at all. She pivoted immediately to a massive structural issue, what she called the regulatory gap. She basically admitted that the laws on the books are totally obsolete.
Okay, let's dig into that regulatory gap. Because it sounds like legal jargon, but it's actually fascinating.
It is. She acknowledged that the current Electronic Communications Act, the ECA, was built for a completely different era of physics and technology.
Physics. Wait, how does physics play into this?
Well, the ECA was designed for old school linear broadcasting, radio, and television. To understand why that matters, you really have to understand how legacy media was regulated. It was built entirely around the concept of scarce radio spectrum.
Oh, right, because there's only so many frequencies. Yeah.
Exactly. If I set up a radio tower and broadcast on 94.7 FM, and you set up a tower next door and try to broadcast on 94.7 FM, our signals physically cancel each other out.
It's a finite resource.
Yes. Because the radio frequency spectrum is a finite physical resource and it belongs to the public, the government has to step in. They act as a traffic cop. They issue licenses to decide who gets to use it and what their obligations are to the public in exchange for that monopoly.
But the internet throws that entire physics textbook out the window. I mean, digital audio on demand doesn't use scarce radio spectrum. It's built on infinite bandwidth and server space.
It's exactly.
Like, me uploading a podcast to YouTube doesn't physically prevent you from uploading a podcast to YouTube. We aren't fighting over a frequency.
Precisely. The scarcity model is totally dead. And because the ECA is built on that scarcity model, the old laws simply do not map onto this new reality of infinite digital real estate. So because of this structural gap, the chairperson identified the actual primary targets of the committee's legislative agenda.
And it is not the local podcasters.
No, it is the OTTs.
Okay, so for those who might not live and breathe telecom jargon, OTT stands for over-the-top platforms.
Yeah.
This is your Google, your Meta, your TikTok, your Spotify.
Right.
And they're called over-the-top because they sit literally over the top of the local internet service providers. The local companies like Telcom or Vodacom, they dig the trenches, lay the fiber optic cables, build the cell towers, manage the physical infrastructure.
Yeah, heavy lifting.
Exactly.
Hmm.
But the OTT platforms swoop in over that infrastructure and just extract the value.
And the government's perspective, which the chair laid out very clearly, is that these global platforms are extracting massive, unprecedented amounts of revenue from South African consumers and local advertisers.
But they aren't paying their fair share.
Right. They are not contributing to the physical infrastructure of the country. They are not employing massive local workforces relative to their revenue. And most importantly, they are largely unaccountable to local laws because their headquarters and servers are sitting in California or Ireland.
Okay, I want to introduce a way to think about this because this hit me when I was reading the source material. It is like the government called a town hall meeting to complain about reckless drivers causing chaos in the streets.
Okay, wake us.
Right, so all the local drivers show up, that's the podcasters, and they're terrified they're going to get their licenses revoked. But when everyone sits down, the mayor bypasses the drivers entirely. The mayor points at the people who pave the roads.
The tech giants.
Exactly, the people who built the highways.
Yeah.
And the mayor says, wait a minute, you built this massive private toll road right through the middle of our city. All our commerce is happening on your asphalt. You are charging our citizens a fortune to drive on it, but you aren't paying any municipal taxes and you aren't following our zoning laws.
That analogy perfectly captures the dynamic. The infrastructure creators are now being held liable for the ecosystem they foster. What's fascinating here is the chairperson's direct callback to history to justify this move.
Oh, the 2016 hearings.
Yes. She referenced the 2016 OTT hearings. 10 years prior to this current roundtable, the South African Parliament tried to engage these platforms. They saw the writing on the wall.
And what happened?
The platforms essentially stonewalled them. They argued, look, we are global tech companies. We are not local broadcasters. We just provide the technology. Don't touch us.
Just a complete brush off.
Completely.
Right.
They pushed back hard against any form of regulation or localization. But now, a decade later, the government feels entirely vindicated. The landscape has matured. The economic extraction is simply too massive to ignore. And the government is essentially saying, we warned you 10 years ago, you didn't self-correct, and now we are establishing the rules.
And she didn't just make this an economic argument, did she? She anchored it in the Constitution.
She did. She stated that any new framework has to balance two seemingly opposing forces. On one side, you have the protection of minors, public interest, and democratic discourse.
Right.
And on the other side, you have Section 16 of the Constitution, which is freedom of expression and creative liberty. The government is trying to build a bridge between the two.
But let's extrapolate the economics for a second, because this is huge for studios like Solid Gold.
Yeah.
If the government actually succeeds here, if they force Meta, Google, and TikTok to localize, to pay fair share taxes, to adhere to local economic frameworks, what does that actually mean for the South African economy?
If executed correctly, it could be entirely transformative. I mean, think about the current flow of capital. When a South African brand buys an ad on a local podcast hosted on YouTube, those advertising rands largely leave the country immediately to sit in Silicon Valley.
It's massive capital flight.
Exactly. But if you stem that flow, if you force a reinvestment into the local digital economy, you are talking about funding local server farms, creating thousands of jobs for localized moderation teams who actually understand South African languages and cultural nuance.
And potentially enforcing direct revenue sharing mandates.
Yes, it shifts South Africa from being merely a passive consumer market that is harvested for data and attention to being an active, capitalized participant in the global digital economy.
That is a massive paradigm shift. But to understand how they actually plan to achieve this, we have to look past the chairperson's opening diplomatic remarks and dig into the specific politicians sitting around that table.
Right, because they are the ones holding the pen.
Exactly. If the platforms are the primary target, what is driving the specific anger, the urgency, and the specific fears of the legislators? We need to read the political tea leaves. We have to look at the baked-in presuppositions and ideological lenses of the committee members, because those lenses are what will ultimately shape the specific clauses of the coming laws.
And this requires a very important disclaimer for you, the listener. Our goal here is impartial reporting of the source material. We are going to unpack the viewpoints of various political parties, from the ANC to the DA to the PA.
Right. We are not endorsing any of these political positions.
Exactly. We're not taking sides. But we must understand the ideological mechanics at play, because these politicians are the ones drafting the legislation.
Okay. Let's start with what was perhaps the most intense ideological lens of the session, the sovereignty and decolonization lens. This was primarily articulated by Honorable Imran Subrati from the ANC, and he did not mince his words.
No, he did not. He posited that the information and communication technology sector, ICT, is the most colonized sector after land in Africa.
Which is a profound framing.
It really is. His argument is rooted in historical media consumption. Historically, South Africans and Africans broadly have only ever been consumers of media and technology created elsewhere. Hollywood movies, American television, European news syndicates.
Right. Always importing the culture.
Yes. So podcasting, in his view, represents the very first time South Africans are truly owners and creators of their own digital narrative at scale, largely unmediated by foreign gatekeepers.
But he doesn't just see it as a purely positive thing, does he?
No, he views this newfound sovereignty as highly vulnerable. He explicitly warned against allowing the podcasting sector to operate as a law unto its own, completely unregulated. He is particularly concerned about foreign actors using these unregulated platforms to spread false narratives, which he views as a direct threat to national sovereignty.
He actually specifically referenced claims of white genocide circulating online, right?
Yes, he did.
He used that as an example of how a narrative can be manufactured or amplified by foreign algorithms to destabilize the local social fabric. So on one hand, he loves the medium for its empowering localized potential. On the other hand, he is terrified of the underlying mechanism being weaponized from the outside.
And that dual view is driving direct legislative action. He formally noted during the session that a misinformation and disinformation bill is already in motion via the ANC caucus.
Wait, really? It's already moving?
Yes. This isn't just theoretical committee chatter. It is a legislative reality moving through the parliamentary pipes right now. The baked-in presupposition here is that the state must act as the ultimate arbiter and protector of truth and sovereignty against global digital platforms.
Okay, so that is the sovereignty angle. But sitting in that same room, you have Honorable Crown Prince Adeline Tshabalang, who brought a completely different energy. He represents the township economy and anti-regulation stance.
And his background is crucial here. He is actually a broadcaster who came up through the podcasting space himself.
So he actually knows the struggle on the ground.
Exactly. His contribution provided the most passionate, pro-industry voice from the political side of the aisle. He fiercely argued against any new legislation targeting local podcasters, and his lens was purely economic and demographic.
What was his main argument against it?
He pointed out a stark reality. For many young people in the townships, podcasting is literally the only viable entrepreneurial opportunity available to them. Traditional barriers to entry and media expensive equipment, studio time, executive gatekeepers are gone.
Yeah, you just need a phone.
Exactly. These youth are starting with smartphones, zero budget, and a data bundle, and they are building audiences of millions.
He made a fascinating point about traditional media, too. He argued that mainstream media often censors or simply ignores these grassroots voices. He even mentioned that his own political party faces gatekeeping from traditional broadcasters.
Right. For him, podcasting isn't just entertainment. It is the only avenue for political and economic freedom for the marginalized. He views any attempt to regulate this space like demanding licenses or imposing heavy compliance costs as effectively crushing a rare economic lifeline for the youth.
So who does he want to target?
He was very pointed in his redirection. He stated that the committee's questions shouldn't be aimed at the podcasters, but squarely at the platforms. He literally asked, what value is YouTube adding to South Africa since they're extracting revenue?
So he completely aligns with the chair on targeting platforms, but his specific motive is different. He wants to build a protective wall around this fragile, booming, grassroots township economy.
Exactly. Now, then you have a third group, the economic pragmatists. We saw this from Honorable Shara Singh of the DA and Honorable Bodhlani of the PA.
And they took a very different approach.
Very different. They stripped away the heavy ideology, both the decolonization aspect and the romanticized township entrepreneur aspect, and focused purely on hard numbers and practical realities.
All right. Honorable Singh raised a highly critical structural question. She asked, is South Africa actually participating meaningfully in this digital economy? Or are we merely providing a massive passive audience for global platforms to monetize?
She was warning the committee that the devil is in the detail regarding any regulation. You can pass all the laws you want, but if the underlying economics mean the platforms still keep 90% of the ad revenue, the laws are useless.
And Honorable Bodhlani pushed even further on that economic reality.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked the question that I think a lot of people were silently wondering. Everyone in the room was talking about podcasting as this booming, massive industry. But he asked, do millionaire podcasters actually exist outside a tiny, highly visible bubble?
It's a great question.
Is this truly an island of excellence spreading wealth? Or is the creator economy just a modern lottery system where a few lucky winners go viral and everyone else makes pennies?
He was fundamentally questioning the actual scale of the success, which is a brilliant segue into the final political grouping we observed, the taxation and identification push.
Oh, this one was intense.
Honorable Ngubane was very emphatic on this front. His stance was essentially, look, nobody exists in a legal or economic vacuum. If podcasters are making huge profits, they need to be paying tax to the fiscus.
And he wanted to track them. Yeah.
Yeah, he went as far as demanding a register, a formal certificate of existence, so the government simply knows who is operating a podcast in the space.
Wait, I have to push back on this. This is where the political logic starts to fracture for me.
How so?
Well, I am listening to these politicians, and the contradiction is glaring. Honorable Ngubane wants to build a massive bureaucratic government register to track and tax podcasters. But literally in the same session, Honorable Bodhlani is asking if profitable podcasters even exist in meaningful numbers.
That is the paradox right there.
How can a committee aggressively pursue taxing an industry when its own members are questioning its actual financial viability? It feels like they are designing a massive tax net to catch a whale without knowing if they are fishing in a puddle.
Your pushback highlights the primary dangerous disconnect between the legislature and the reality of the digital creator economy. The politicians are looking at viral metrics. They see a podcast episode with 3 million views. They see massive social media engagement. They see podcasters driving expensive cars on Instagram.
And they think that equals cash.
Exactly. They conflate that cultural footprint with direct taxable liquidity. They assume 1 million views equates to 1 million rand in the bank. But anyone in the industry knows the monetization of digital content is highly fractured.
Right. It's so platform dependent. YouTube AdSense pays very differently depending on the geography of the viewer. Brand deals are sporadic.
The politicians are reacting to the noise of the industry, assuming the economic foundation is as solid as traditional broadcast advertising.
And this brings us to a massive presupposition that you, the listener, really need to understand, because it is the ghost haunting the entire portfolio committee. It is the number that is driving their urgency.
A big number.
The big number. The politicians in that room cited a staggering figure, R156 billion, spent on data for social media.
That figure is the core economic anxiety of the state. They look at that R156 billion and they don't just see people watching videos, they see a regulatory imperative.
Because it's money leaving the local ecosystem.
Yes. In their eyes, that is South African capital flowing directly out of the pockets of citizens into the hands of local telecommunications monopolies and ultimately driving the ad revenue of international tech platforms. Meanwhile, the young creators who are actually generating the content that keeps people swiping and using that data, they remain largely impoverished.
The director general of the department even hinted that because of this massive data spend, an imminent cabinet announcement regarding the cost to communicate was expected before Easter.
They view high data costs as a massive barrier to entry. If you are trying to build a township economy, but your creators and your audience can't afford the data to upload or stream the content, the economy suffocates.
So if we synthesize all these wildly different viewpoints, From the ANC's push for decolonization to Schebaling's defense of township entrepreneurship to the DA's pragmatic economics to the push for taxation, a massive, highly unusual cross-party consensus actually emerges.
Despite their fierce political differences, every single party implicitly agreed on three core pillars. One, protect the Black-owned digital economy at all costs. Two, force global platforms to stop extracting wealth unchecked. And three, radically lower data costs for consumers.
So on one hand, the government wants to protect the economics. They want the platforms to pay. They want data to be cheaper. They want the youth to thrive. But there is a massive vibe that dominated the second half of this session.
And this is where things got really tense.
While they love the economics of podcasting, they are deeply, deeply terrified of the content going viral on these platforms. What exactly are these politicians trying to stop, and how do civil society and the legal experts propose fixing it without resorting to state censorship?
The fear of the content itself is palpable, and for many of these politicians, it is highly personal. Deputy Minister Mamdo Gungo Bale was surprisingly candid about this.
What did he say?
He admitted to The Room that he is a regular podcast consumer and a YouTuber himself, but he shared a deeply personal grievance. He said he has watched podcasts where he was, in his exact words, murdered very badly.
Wow. Murdered very badly.
Yes, meaning his reputation, his character, and his political record were ruthlessly attacked in front of an audience of hundreds of thousands.
And his core frustration was the lack of a right of reply, wasn't it?
Exactly. In traditional print journalism or television, if a newspaper runs a front page story heavily criticizing you, there is an established ethical mechanism. It's governed by the press ombudsman. Mm. It allows you to write a response, and they are obligated to publish it.
But in the wild west of podcasting,
the deputy minister lamented that not a single podcast that attacked him ever reached out for comment, responded to his emails, or gave him a platform to defend himself. He felt he was convicted in the court of public opinion with no defense attorney.
When a deputy minister feels personally helpless and defenseless against a medium, legislation almost always follows.
Always.
And it wasn't just him. Honorable Abrams shared incredibly painful stories from his constituency, detailing how everyday people have been targeted by racial slurs, doxing, and discrimination from specific online podcasters.
The harm they are discussing isn't abstract political theory. It is real, it is visceral, and it is the primary emotional driver for their desire to act. But the constitutional paradox remains. How do you stop that specific harm without breaking the constitutional right to freedom of expression?
This is where civil society stepped into the room with what I genuinely consider the most brilliant conceptual pivot of the entire roundtable.
It was a game changer.
We heard from Tina Power, a human rights lawyer from Alt Advisory, and William Byrd, the director of Media Monitoring Africa. Their core argument was revolutionary, especially for a government committee that is used to command and control regulation.
They looked at the politicians and essentially said, "Do not regulate what the individual podcaster says. If you try to police speech, you will end up in endless censorship battles, constitutional court challenges, and you will stifle the very township economy you are trying to protect.
Instead, regulate the platform system."
Regulate systems, not speech. It is a profound paradigm shift. What Tina Power and William Byrd explained is the underlying architecture of the internet. They explain that platforms like YouTube, TikTok, and Meta are not passive libraries where videos just sit on a shelf waiting to be found.
No, they're active, algorithmic engines designed explicitly to be addictive.
Their funding models, programmatic advertising, actively reward and incentivize polarization, outrage, misogyny, and racism.
Let's break down exactly how that works mechanically for the listener, because this is the core of it. An algorithm on a social platform is optimizing for one primary metric: time on site.
The longer you stay on the app, the more ads they can serve you, the more money they make.
Exactly. And human psychology dictates that anger, outrage, and fear keep us engaged far longer than nuanced, calm debate. So if a podcaster says something highly controversial, highly offensive, or potentially harmful, the platform's algorithm immediately detects the surge in user engagement.
All the angry comments, the shares, the watch time.
Right. The algorithm then artificially amplifies that content, pushing it into the feeds of millions of people who weren't even looking for it, specifically to harvest their outrage.
The algorithm acts as a hyper-aggravating editor. Byrd and Power argue that the regulation must target that specific amplification system, the algorithmic design, rather than punishing the speaker after the fact.
So you hold the platform accountable for the environment and the amplification mechanics it has engineered.
Exactly. If a platform system is proven to systematically promote hate speech for profit, the platform faces the regulatory penalty, not just the teenager who uploaded the video.
It's like, instead of trying to arrest every single person who shouts in a crowded theater, you regulate the person who installed massive stadium-grade megaphones and handed them out exclusively to the angriest people in the room. You don't regulate the voice, you regulate the amplification hardware.
That is a perfect way to put it. And Dr. Sizwe Mpofu-Walsh, who was arguably the most influential and articulate industry voice in the room, broke this down into a highly practical framework to help the politicians understand what is actually manageable.
He identified three tiers of regulation, right?
Yes. Tier one is dignity harms. This includes hate speech, defamation, and incitement to violence. His point was clear. We do not need new podcast-specific laws for this. It is already covered by the existing legal system and the courts.
Right. Then tier two, he identified as explicitness. This is violence, nudity, child protection issues. He noted that the tech platforms actually already moderate this quite strictly.
Yeah, you cannot post a violent beheading or explicit material on YouTube or TikTok without their automated systems taking it down almost immediately.
Why? Because brands like Coca-Cola or Nike will pull their advertising instantly if their ads run next to that content. The free market and platform terms of service largely regulate tier two.
Which leaves tier three, truth and accuracy. Disinformation, deepfakes, organized political manipulation. This, Mpofu-Walsh argued, is the real unresolved battleground.
Because it's subjective.
Yes. This is where the harm is occurring that neither the courts nor the platforms are currently managing effectively. Because truth is highly subjective and incredibly difficult for an algorithm to moderate at scale without severe bias.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this precise gap is why civil society is pushing so hard for a completely new model of oversight. They proposed the creation of an online safety authority.
And we really need to pay close attention to this because there was a massive turf war happening in that room over this exact issue.
The FPB, right?
Yes. Throughout the session, the Film and Publication Board, the FPB, was aggressively trying to position itself as the natural regulator for podcasts. The FPB already classifies movies, games, and traditional media, so they argued they should just extend their mandate to cover the internet.
But William Byrd and the civil society groups strongly, strongly pushed back against giving the FPB that power.
The reason for that pushback comes down to one critical word: independence. When you are dealing with fundamental rights like freedom of speech, political discourse, and journalism, the regulatory body must be fiercely, structurally independent from both government pressure and corporate platform influence.
And they felt the FPB wasn't.
Civil society argued that the FPB, as it is currently constituted, lacks that necessary statutory independence. It is too closely tied to the executive branch of government. An online safety authority, on the other hand, would be a bespoke, independent body, perhaps modeled structurally like the IEC or the Public Protector.
Designed specifically to hold global platforms accountable for their systemic algorithmic harms without acting as a government censor classifying individual speech.
Precisely.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me, though. We are talking about all these grand new authorities, new legislative frameworks, algorithmic audits, but we had actual practicing legal experts in the room throwing a massive reality check on the entire proceeding.
Yeah, the lawyer stepped in.
Media law attorney Adwa Abraham and Huda Tumampa, the head of legal at Prime Media, essentially raised their hands, stopped the panic, and said, hold on a second. Podcasters do not exist in a legal vacuum.
It was a vital intervention that completely grounded the conversation. They reminded the committee that South Africa already has an incredibly robust, world-class legal framework that applies perfectly well to the internet.
Defamation laws exist.
The Protection of Personal Information Act, POPIA, which governs data privacy, exists. If a podcaster defames you or publishes your private information maliciously, you can sue them right now. You do not need a new podcast act to do it.
Tumapa specifically brought up the Bagoshi defense, which is crucial context here. For those who aren't familiar with South African media law, National Media Ltd v. Bagoshi is a landmark Supreme Court of Appeal case from 1998.
It's the foundational case for media freedom here.
Exactly. It essentially established that the media can publish defamatory statements and they won't be held liable if they can prove it was reasonable to do so in the pursuit of truth and public interest.
It established the rules of engagement for journalists, things like giving the subject a right of reply, verifying sources, and acting in good faith.
So my ultimate question is, if we already have the Bagoshi defense, if we already have strict defamation laws and POPIA protecting privacy, Why on earth is Parliament trying to reinvent the wheel for podcasts? Are they just technologically illiterate, or is there a genuine mechanical gap that the law currently doesn't cover?
It is a mix of both, but there is a very genuine mechanical gap. The law itself exists, but the accessibility of recourse is entirely broken in the digital age. Honorable Bodlani touched on this brilliantly. Imagine a podcaster defames you to an audience of 2 million people on a Tuesday. Under the current system, your only recourse is to hire a very expensive media lawyer, file an urgent application in the high court, and maybe get a judgment or a retraction months or even years later.
By that time, the viral damage is permanent.
Exactly. The clip has been downloaded, remixed, and shared on WhatsApp a million times. Your reputation is ruined, and you are financially drained from legal fees.
So the politicians are trying to reinvent the wheel because the current legal wheel moves like a horse and carriage, while the internet moves at the speed of light. They want fast, low-cost, accessible dispute resolution.
They want that right of reply to be as instant as the harm itself, without requiring a high court judge.
Furthermore, as Adwa Abraham pointed out, the jurisdictional challenge of the internet is a legal nightmare. Let's say a local podcaster defames you, but the video is hosted on a server in California by a company headquartered in Ireland.
Good luck with that.
Right. Serving a legal takedown notice under South African law, across international borders, to a tech giant that ignores you, is incredibly complex and costly. That jurisdictional friction is the exact gap the government is trying to close by forcing the platforms to localize and be accountable to domestic law.
That makes perfect sense. The theory of the law is sound, but the enforcement mechanics fail entirely at the speed and scale of the digital age.
So Parliament clearly has these grand sweeping ideas about taxing the industry, regulating algorithmic systems, and speeding up legal recourse. But what happens when the actual podcasters and industry executives, the people who actually build this ecosystem every single day, tell them about the reality on the ground?
It was a harsh wake-up call.
Let's look at the reality of the industry, because the gap between what Parliament thinks the creator economy is and what it actually is staggering.
The contrast was jarring. Parliament seems to view the podcasting industry as a monolith, a unified army of highly profitable, massive influencers wielding enormous political power. But Baladama, the CEO of the Podcast and Chill Network, which is widely recognized as the largest in the country, dropped an absolute reality bomb on the committee.
He laid out the analytics plainly, didn't he?
He did. He told the room that there is only one podcast in South Africa with over 3 million unique viewers. There is only one with over 2 million. Only one with over 500,000.
And he was largely talking about his own network's flagship shows.
Yes. His point was not to boast, but to demonstrate that the top tier, the highly visible mega podcasts that the politicians are reacting to and terrified of, is infinitesimally small. It is a statistical anomaly. The vast, overwhelming majority of podcasts in South Africa fall drastically, exponentially below those numbers.
This data was completely corroborated by Jonathan Wonka, the managing director of the SA Podcasters Guild. He represented the grassroots truth. He told the committee that his organization has 535 registered members.
And what are these people talking about?
They aren't sitting around microphones plotting to tear down the government or defaming deputy ministers. They're talking about fly fishing. They are talking about remote-controlled car drifting. They are reviewing local comic books. They are passionate hobbyists.
Wonka pointed out that out of those hundreds of members, he could probably count on two hands the number of people who actually make enough money from their podcast to generate a taxable income.
Which completely dismantles Honorable Ingobain's demand for a massive tax register. You're proposing a bureaucratic framework to tax an ecosystem of passionate hobbyists who are largely operating at a financial loss.
It would cost the government more to administer the register than they would ever collect in taxes.
But Baladama didn't just bring sobering statistics to the table, right? He brought a highly strategic corporate proposal.
Yes, he told the committee to stop obsessing over regulating individual content and start focusing entirely on the flow of money.
His pitch was phenomenal. He said, don't just regulate the tech platforms and hope they share the wealth. Instead, mandate that corporate digital media budgets in South Africa allocate a mandatory 1% directly to local podcasters, rather than funneling 100% of their digital spend through the tech platform's programmatic ad networks.
To understand why this is so revolutionary, you really have to understand how media agencies buy ads today. If a massive local bank wants to run a digital ad campaign, they don't usually call up individual podcasters.
No, it's all automated.
Right. They give millions of rands to a media agency who plugs it into Google or Meta's programmatic ad exchange. The algorithm spreads the ads everywhere, taking a massive cut of the money before a tiny fraction ever reaches the local creator whose video the ad played on.
Dama is saying, bypass the algorithmic middleman. Force corporate South Africa to take 1% of that massive budget and invest it directly into the local ecosystem, sponsoring shows, funding studios, buying direct ad reads.
Instead of asking the government for a handout or waiting for Google to generously increase their AdSense revenue share, mandate that local corporate marketing budgets build the local industry. It is a brilliant mechanism.
But to get that kind of direct corporate investment, you need a highly professionalized industry. A bank isn't going to give a million rands to a podcaster who might curse out their CEO the next day.
Exactly. And that is where we hit another massive roadblock discussed in the session, the infrastructure and measurement crisis.
The foundation has to be solid before you can build the skyscraper.
You had Muthibi Ramusi, the chairperson of ICASA, raising a fundamental infrastructural question. Does South Africa even have the solid technological backbone, the broadband penetration in rural areas, the localized server capacity, the national grid stability to support a booming, data-heavy podcasting industry at true national scale?
He was deeply concerned that the physical infrastructure would bottleneck the digital growth.
But the more immediate crisis for monetization came from Gary Whitaker, the CEO of the Broadcast Research Council. He laid down a simple, undeniable law of media economics. Without standardized measurement, there is no trust. And without trust, there is no corporate investment.
This is a massive issue for the creator economy. Because right now, how do you actually measure a podcast's success? Spotify gives you one set of analytics dashboard. Apple Podcasts gives you a completely different set with different definitions of a listen.
YouTube gives you views, but what about average view duration?
Right. What about the people who support the creator on Patreon? What about the 5,000 people who buy tickets to show up to a live podcast recording at an arena? Wonka pointed out that the true engagement metrics of this industry are completely hidden and fragmented.
If a corporate brand is going to spend millions of rands, they need a standardized, independent, audited metric to prove their return on investment. In traditional radio, this is the RAMS, the Radio Audience Measurement Survey. Yeah. In television, it used to be ARMS, the audience ratings.
These are trusted third-party currencies that the entire industry agrees upon. A brand knows exactly what a listener is worth.
And until the podcasting industry unites to create that unified, trusted measurement standard, they will always struggle to attract that 1% direct corporate spend. They will be viewed as a risky, unquantifiable experiment rather than a primary advertising vehicle.
This ties perfectly into Dr. Mpofu Walsh's profound observation during the session. He called the podcasting space a rare island of excellence.
Yes, it is one of the very few sectors in the South African economy that is truly Black-led, completely independent, and organically financially sustainable, at least at the top end.
His stark warning to the committee was that any clumsy state regulation, any attempt to force traditional broadcast licensing onto this fragile digital ecosystem would absolutely devastate it, would sink the island.
We need a better way to conceptualize this than just an island. Think of the creator economy not as an industry, but as a massive national lottery system.
We have a lottery.
The politicians are looking at the one person holding the giant novelty check for 3 million rands. They are terrified of the influence that lottery winner has, and they want to pass sweeping laws to tax and regulate anyone who even thinks about playing.
But they're completely ignoring the millions of people who are just buying a 2 rand ticket every week, hoping for a break, operating at a loss.
Exactly. If you regulate the people buying the tickets, the entire system collapses. You have to regulate the corporation running the lottery, the platforms themselves.
So we have taken this massive, deep journey through the minds of the legislators, the systemic solutions proposed by the lawyers, and the hard reality checks delivered by the creators. Now, let's distill all of this chaos, all these transcripts, into absolute, actionable certainties.
This is the playbook.
What is inevitable? And what should studios like Solid Gold and independent creators do about it right now?
Yeah.
Let's start with the inevitabilities. What is absolutely 100% going to happen based on the momentum in that room?
Based on the transcripts, the baked-in political presuppositions, and the cross-party consensus, there are 4 absolute inevitabilities you need to prepare for. First, OTT and platform regulation is 100% coming.
No avoiding it.
None. The committee views this as an urgent, overdue priority. The global tech platforms will be forced into some form of localization, whether that is mandatory revenue sharing, forced local investment, or fair share taxation.
Second,
a misinformation and disinformation bill will be formally introduced into Parliament. The ANC caucus has already drafted the bones of it, and the cross-party fear of AI deepfakes and organized fake news during election cycles gives it overwhelming momentum.
Okay, so the platforms get regulated, and a fake news bill is imminent. What else?
Third, the white paper on audio and audiovisual media, which has been circulating in draft form for years, will finally move toward formal legislation. However, the regulatory model that emerges will not be a single dictator regulator.
ITIS is not going to take over the internet.
Yeah, no. It will be a collaborative, multi-entity model. You might see the information regulator handling the PoPIA data privacy aspects, an independent online safety authority handling the audits of platform algorithms, and industry bodies handling content complaints.
And the fourth inevitability.
Fourth, and perhaps the most reassuring inevitability for the creators listening, podcasters will not be individually licensed like radio stations. IKESA will not get direct jurisdiction over your specific podcast in the short term. The government realizes that trying to license a million hobbyists would be administrative suicide.
Okay. That is the landscape. So how do we navigate it? If you are a studio executive running a professional operation like Solid Gold, managing multiple shows and high-end clients, or you are an ambitious indie creator trying to build a sustainable business, what are your start, stop, and keep actions?
Let's give them the playbook.
What do they need to start doing today, right now?
You need to start embracing self-regulation before it is forcefully imposed upon you by the state. The committee made it very, very clear. They prefer the industry to sort itself out. They do not want to micromanage if they don't have to.
For a studio like Solid Gold, this means formally adopting and publishing internal codes of conduct.
Exactly. If you are producing anything that resembles actuality, political commentary, or news content, you need to heed the advice of Dr. Patiso Magapane from the Press Council. Start signing up with the Press Council voluntarily.
What does that actually look like in practice, though?
It means submitting to their ethical code. It means if someone feels defamed by one of your shows, they can go to the press ombudsman instead of the high court. It provides you with a shield of credibility, and it provides the politicians with the established mechanism for that right of reply they are so desperate for.
What about the metrics?
Furthermore, you need to start pushing aggressively for standardized industry measurement. Work actively with bodies like the IAB, the Interactive Advertising Bureau, and the Broadcast Research Council to unify your metrics. You cannot attract that 1% corporate capital until you can prove your numbers in a language that banks and ad agencies understand.
I love that. Be proactive, not reactive. Build the fence of credibility before the government builds a wall of regulation. Okay, what do creators and studios need to stop doing?
Stop worrying about direct government content censorship. The pervasive fear that a government agent is going to listen to your specific podcast and shut down your studio for criticizing the mayor is largely unfounded based on the reality of this session.
The constitutional protections of Section 16 remain incredibly strong.
Yes, and the state has no desire to fight a million constitutional court battles. What you also need to start doing is waiting passively for global platforms to voluntarily share their revenue more fairly. Stop hoping YouTube's algorithm will suddenly favor you financially.
Instead, start lobbying collectively through the Podcasters Guild for that 1% direct corporate ad spend that Baladama proposed.
Stop treating the tech platform as your employer and start treating corporate South Africa as your direct client.
That is a crucial mindset shift. Stop begging the algorithmic landlord for a discount on your rent and start building your own house with local bricks. And finally, what do they need to keep doing?
Keep building Black-owned intellectual property and keep creating youth jobs. This is the single most powerful political shield you possess. As we saw, Parliament views the Black ownership and job creation within the podcasting sector as politically sacred.
Honorable Chevalling made that abundantly clear.
If Solid Gold can demonstrate that it is a tangible engine for youth employment, skills transfer, and ownership in the digital economy, you transform from a regulatory target into a protected national asset.
Also, keep focusing on public interest content. Uyandis Hutwila from the SOS Coalition suggested something fascinating, that the government might soon incentivize or even zero rate data for public interest content.
Yes. If you are creating high-quality, educational, culturally significant material, you might find yourself on the receiving end of government support, where your audience doesn't even have to pay for the data to listen to you.
So what does this all mean? It means the Wild West era of the South African internet is closing. But the new era isn't a dictatorship. It's a formalized municipality.
And the most important takeaway is this. The people who organize now, the studios like Solid Gold who adopt codes of conduct tomorrow, the creators who join the SA Podcasters Guild, the networks that work with the IAB to build trusted metrics, they are the ones who will be sitting at the table when the final clauses of these laws are drafted.
If you are unorganized and isolated, you will be regulated. If you are organized and unified, you become the regulator.
That is the ultimate truth of policymaking in any industry. If you aren't at the table, you are on the menu. But in this specific case, the government is actively, almost desperately, inviting the industry to the table. It is entirely up to the industry to pull up a chair and take the seat.
Let's briefly recap this incredible journey we've been on. We started this deep dive expecting a terrifying story about a paranoid government cracking down on independent voices and crushing free speech.
But what we actually uncovered was something far more complex, highly nuanced, and honestly far more exciting.
We realized the South African government is gearing up for a massive, unprecedented showdown with global tech platforms. They're trying to protect a booming, organically grown, locally owned digital economy, the township creators, the independent studios, from being economically extracted and algorithmically manipulated by Silicon Valley.
It's not about silencing the guy with the microphone. It's about making the platforms pay for the massive digital roads they've built their empires on.
It is a profound shift in regulatory philosophy, moving from controlling speech to managing systemic economic infrastructure. But as we look to the future, as we map out all these inevitabilities, there is one final chilling thought experiment that we need to leave you, the listener, with.
Amidst all the intense debate about defamation laws, taxation registers, and platform algorithms, two of the most forward-thinking people in that room, Bala Dama from the industry side and William Byrd from the civil society side, both issued a stark warning to the committee about something almost no one else was prepared to discuss.
Artificial intelligence.
Yes, the AI warning. It felt like science fiction, but it is arriving tomorrow. Bala Dama made a chilling prediction based on where the technology is currently tracking. He looked at the committee and said that within 5 years, AI will be running entirely localized, highly engaging podcasts without human hosts.
We're talking about fully synthetic, hyper-realistic voices, generating culturally nuanced scripts based on real-time data scraping and operating completely autonomously.
Which is mind-blowing on a technological level, but think about the absolute legal chaos that implies based on everything we just spent the last hour discussing.
Parliament is preparing to spend the next 3 to 5 years debating how to regulate human podcasters. They are trying to figure out how to manage platform algorithms and how to apply the Bugocci defense to a guy in his bedroom.
But what happens to the deputy minister's desperate plea for a right of reply? What happens to our defamation laws and the sacred township economy of human creators when the most popular, viral, and influential podcaster in South Africa isn't actually a person at all?
What happens when it is a hyper-localized AI model trained on South African data, generating infinite content, but owned by a server in another jurisdiction with no human editor to hold accountable?
If a synthetic AI voice defames you to an audience of 5 million people, who do you subpoena then?
That is the true frontier. You walked into Parliament worried about who gets to hold the microphone, but the real question coming for all of us is what happens when there is no one sitting behind the mic at all? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the March 25th roundtable.
We hope this has given you the clarity, the historical context, and the actionable playbook you need to navigate the coming changes.
Whether you are steering the ship at Solid Gold or creating your very first show from your living room, stay curious, keep building your independent IP, and most importantly, keep questioning the algorithms that feed you. Until next time.